Resources Committee is convened at about 6 minutes after the 1 o'clock deadline. Present are Representative Guttenberg, Representative Seaton, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, and Co-Chair Gatto. We have two bills before us today, and they're 5-pound gooey ducks or 1,000-pound bears. Today is the day that we visit the realm of zoology, and both of them pertain to what to do about the issues that surround each of these critters. And we have one person here who has both bills, and that would be Representative Seaton. So the fact that we're all here for this is, well, never mind. His fault, but I promised him I would be here for this, and we are. So House Bill 26, sir. From here if you like, from there if you like.
Doesn't matter to me.
Put your thing up there. Sure. Just going to help you?
If I need help. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 26 deals with gooey ducks, and basically it is a very simple bill that just says that the Department of Fish and Game cannot use the absence of gooey ducks in an area as the reason for denying a mariculture farm permit. The all of the other conditions, whether of permitting, which include it's in the farm site is in the correct habitat, type, sediment, all of those normal procedures, as well as health of the animals, all of those are still in place. So that the only thing that this does is lets the gooey duck farmers who are in an area that don't have gooey ducks apply for permits. Gooey ducks are a very interesting animal. They're the largest clam in North America, surely, and it's some references say it's the largest in the world. And what they do is they are benthic. That means they're on the bottom. They dig down in the soil. In fact, the word is kind of a English derivation of the word, an Indian word from down in Puget Sound that means deep digger. And these clams are not mobile at all. They're not like a razor clam that can dig away for, as the tide comes in and you get wave action, or if somebody's trying to dig up a razor clam, the clam can actually dig away. These dig at about 1 foot per year as they grow, and so they're totally non-mobile. And in fact, if you take the clam out and lay it on the bottom, it won't even be able to dig itself back in as a adult clam. These animals became very valuable as marketing has improved. It used to be they were between $1 and $2 a pound, and now they're $10 a pound because they're sold live to Europe, to Asia, where they're very much prized. There is not a problem with the economics between the areas. I mean, it's not a competition problem. People recognize that the more clams that come from Alaska, the better source Alaska will be seen as a source for gooey ducks. Their range is basically from Puget Sound through Canada and up into southeastern Alaska to as far north as Tenneke Springs, which is south here, south of Juneau Lake. And so if we can provide an economic base for the isolated communities that go from here all the way up around Kodiak and out the Alaska Peninsula, it's something that would be very valuable. There are no known infectious diseases in these animals, either in the wild, they haven't been identified, nor in the farming that is taking place in both Washington and British Columbia. So, in fact, in one of the papers that Fish and Game has put here, they say that there are no known diseases of transport significance. In other words, anything that would be there that they would worry about transporting from one area to another, nothing that they've found. And of course, these have been farmed for quite a while down in Washington and British Columbia, so those things would probably have been seen. The only thing that they have seen is they're called warts on the clams, but that's caused by some cells in the muscle tissue that the clam decides it doesn't like in there, and it moves it to the outside and forms these kind of warts on the outside. But they've analyzed those, and there's no infectious agent that is causing that. So there's nothing known there, like I say, as far as that, as far as diseases. In fact, these are probably some of the longest-living animals in the world. There are reports of various analyses between 140 and 168 years old. So, you know, they're doing something right with their bodies, and obviously they're a long-lived creature, but they grow fairly fast as small clams, so harvestable in about 7 years. The bill that we have has a restriction so that north of Southeastern, these farms would be subtitle, not intertidal permits. And this means that we won't have an interaction between people that land skiffs on beach, people that pick up seaweed, pick up dig clams or anything else, because these will all be subtidal. In other words, they won't be exposed even at a very low tide. So that's where these are going to be located. These farms would be located. The farms also don't require the tremendous number of buoys that we have with suspended culture for the oyster farms that occur up in Prince William Sound and Cook Inlet. There has been conflicts there where people have farms in bays where people no longer can really boat very well because there are just all these buoys with these suspended cultures. And these are on the bottom benthic farms, and so we wouldn't have that conflict. So there's been no identified conflict. There has been, people have identified that these are out of the larval drift zones. If they were active, the probability is that these will be like oysters and that they will not be sexually active, sexually mature. In other words, they won't be putting out larvae into the water column as they get north of here. There is, we can't tell that for sure, but the interesting thing is we've been looking at what is the difference of having gooey ducks in an area and not having gooey ducks in an area. That's the ecological interaction. And that ecological interaction was apparently not too much of a problem here in Southeast because Fish and Game has permitted a farm 35 miles north of Juneau, and they identify that the northern part of their viable population range is Tenakee Springs. So they've permitted a farm that's outside the area in which gooey ducks are living, and that is the ecological interaction that you would be talking about. So it hasn't been a concern there, and there's been no identified ecological concern other than just a general idea of, well, these is a species that's not there, so we want to worry about it. I think that we have a good case to be made for what the ecology impact is, because you have gooey ducks in southern Southeast, and you have no gooey ducks up here north of Juneau, and yet the ecology, and you still have the same species of salmon in their areas. You have herring, you have halibut, you have sea pens, you have all these other ecological things that are very similar that, you know, are not. So it doesn't seem to be that there's a detriment to southern Southeast from having gooey duck clams. And so I think that this, Mr. Chairman, this bill represents a way to provide a possible economic base for the isolated communities with very little risk of introducing a new species. It's not a new species to Alaska. There's nothing in this bill that would allow importing of gooey duck seed from outside of Alaska. It would have to be raised at a certified hatchery in Alaska from Alaskan stock. And so that's the basis of the bill, and hopefully can provide an economic base for coastal communities.
Committee questions? Representative Kawasaki?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question on the farm that's located just south of here. How long has that been around?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kawasaki, the farm was permitted for Bridget Cove, and it's north of here. It's above the range of where they say the natural range for gooey ducks is, and it hasn't been in operation yet. It's been permitted, but it hasn't gone into operation.
Okay, then to follow up, Mr. Chairman, on the attachment one, introduced species in our packet, it comments that, you know, there's introduced species, I might read, are a major threat because of interactions that are unpredictable. I guess if we could just get kind of a comment to that.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Kawasaki, I am very cognizant of that. I have been very opposed to finfish farming, those kind of things. I would be, you know, I would not be supportive at all if somebody wanted to bring a predatory or a mobile species into an area. I think that what we're looking at here is a species that is sedentary, stays in one spot. We have a history of this species in the state of Alaska in southeastern here. We can look at the ecology of southern southeast and northern southeast, and we don't see an impact of, well, gooey ducks are here, so now we don't have any sea otters. We have sea otters in both northern and southern. We have halibut in both areas. We have sea pens in both areas. So this idea of this being a species that we have no history with, or we can't make a reasonable projection, I don't think is a I don't think is reasonable assumption to make. I think we've got a lot of information just by looking at southern southeast. I mean, southeast Alaska at a laboratory, and we can say, does the presence of gooey ducks in southern southeast displace other animals that are present in northern southeast? And you know, nobody has presented any information that that's the case. So this is not like introducing a lobster or a crab or a mussel species that goes and attaches wherever you have a hard substrate. You know, we've had zebra mussels that have been transmitted in ballast water that have then clogged pipes. These creatures have to be in sediment. They have to be, you know, buried in the right kind of substrate. They're not going to be competing in with such things as razor clams, or nobody has identified anything that they would compete with the so I guess that's the ecological circumstance, if that was the question.
Thank you.
Representative Guttenberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you give it to you, could you give us an idea of who's here to testify, kind of how
I have only a single name from Fish and Game, John Hilsinger, okay, who is here, or there you are. Here.
No, that's not me, Mr. Chair, but I signed up to testify.
Okay, I don't have that, but I will get it.
I was just wondering how, if there was testimony on it, if there was going to be, the department was going to speak on it, whether or not I find more questions or comments to Representative Seaton, or trying to figure out who's going to be here.
And I think I understand your concern. Your concern is probably the biology, be my mm-hmm. guess. And both Representative Seaton and I have masters in biology. His is in zoology, mine is in ecology. And we've talked about this at some length. I had a horrible concern, to be honest, over introducing a species in an environment not previously present. But it's interesting in that the environment that he's talking about is unoccupied?
Mr. Chairman, basically we're talking about fine sediments, mud flats, those kind of things. The occupation of an environment is something that's hard to you know, hard to say it's unoccupied. The department had expressed some concern that polychaete worms, which are these big segmented worms, could be influenced, and yet the only study that's been done is that looking at areas where after they've harvested gooey ducks, there was actually a slight increase in the number of polychaete worms. So, you know, there hasn't been an identification that sea pens don't exist, coexist in the same area or anything else. So other than a generalized idea that, well, it might influence something. I mean, they do eat. They're filter feeders, you know. They eat plankton. So, of course, if you plant them too densely, they're going to grow more slowly. But generally, there's nothing of commercial significance, certainly, and there's nothing that has been identified of sport or subsistence significance that these gooey ducks have displaced in southern southeastern that exist in northern southeastern. So there, although there's a general concern of environmental conditions, there has been no identified species that gooey ducks would displace.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Seaton, have you talked to any of the people that are involved with the gooey duck industry now to see how they feel about this or what their thinking is or anything like that?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes, I have. You know, the only concern originally was, would there be a problem with marketing? Would they worry about there being too many gooey ducks? And I think we have some people from the industry that will testify, but my conversations with those folks are that they're not worried about that at all. In fact, the reverse is probably true. The more gooey ducks that start coming from Alaska will be seen as a much better supplier. It's, you know, it's kind of one of those things, like you can get a synergy of effect if you have enough coming from an area, then people look to that area. But the market, and hopefully some of the folks from the industry will testify, is pretty much unlimited in for the live gooey ducks in Asia. And so there have been no concerns addressed that way. The as you know from previous testimony in fisheries, that there was some question about these larval drift zones. And some people had a concern, if you of course the stock would be stock from southeastern, but would there be any chance of, if they become reproductively active in the Prince William Sound or Kodiak area, would those larvae impact southeastern? And of course, by the larval drift zone that they show, there would be no impact at all. The possibility of larvae getting from Kodiak or out west into southeastern is, you know, almost impossible, according to their larval drift zone theory.
Follow up. I have one more question, and that is, I've had some gooey duck farmers that, because my concern is who's providing the seed and where the seed's coming from, and isn't that from an area close to this area that we're talking about now?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the gooey ducks would have to come from Alaska. They would have to be supplied and from southeastern, from the populations down here. They cannot be imported into the state. And it can only come from the Alaska certified hatcheries. And there is only one currently, and that is in Seward that does it. And I mean, we're talking about 5 or 10 animals. So we're not talking about very many animals to supply the number of seed they need to reproduce the gooey ducks.
Well, would I follow up?
Follow up.
What I'm thinking is, this is what happened one time to one of my gooey duck farmers in my district. He ordered the seed, he paid for the seed, but he didn't get the seed. And I guess you have to seed it at a planet or whatever you do, a certain time of the year, and it got past that time. And so he had to wait for a whole nother season to do this. And actually, I'm thinking about, well, golly, if that area opens up over there and we only have one place that's going to provide the seed, then is that going to, who's going to get the first batch, you know? And so, I mean, that could be something. And I'm just kind of thinking out loud about concerns for the Gooey Duck farmers in my area. So.
And through the chair, Representative Wilson, you do have in your packet here a letter from the hatchery manager. And part of the big problem with the with supplying Gooey Ducks is there's only been a few farms, and they can't get people to commit to ordering. And so unless you have more diversity of supply, it's hard to be raising expensive Gooey Ducks ahead of time and then having no one come up and order them or buy them. And so what will happen is if you have more people purchasing, then the hatchery can actually plan ahead and go ahead and make sure they're raising plenty of Gooey Ducks to supply the industry. The problem with the Gooey Ducks supply from the hatchery has been that there haven't been enough farms permitted to really get the hatch to make orders and to have orders and be able to put money on the table. And that's one of the things we're talking about here with the hatchery, is that the state put in, I think it was $2.3 million into getting the mariculture hatchery going, and it is working on oysters. But we have a part of our law that says you can import oysters from outside. So we get oysters from Washington, which is in itself a somewhat dangerous practice, because we're bringing those up, importing them, and you could have other things imported with them. But the whole business plan of the hatchery revolves not only around oysters and cockles and those things, but also around Gooey Ducks, because they are a valuable piece. And they haven't been able to get enough orders from the farmers in Southeast to make that. So we either need to make the decision that we're going to subsidize the mariculture hatchery, or we're going to let it generate enough money so that it, within coordination with the industry, can be self-sustaining, or we have to just say we're going to get out of the mariculture business. And so it's difficult in that respect, because Gooey Ducks were a significant portion of the plan, and there's only really been one person put down in the past money for Gooey Duck seed ahead of time. And so they've, you know, done some raising speculatively, but permitting has been a problem. So hopefully that's going to change as some of these plants come on board.
Thank you.
Let me ask a question, and then I'll get right to you. Is the hatchery currently operating that would supply the seed?
Mr. Chairman, yes, the hatchery is currently operating. There was a big flood, you know, this last year, and they got back up and running. In fact, I think he had the in fisheries this last week, they had a presentation about the king crab larvae that they're trying to work with, and that's for a rehabilitation of existing stocks. And but the hatchery is in production. Yes.
And we mentioned Representative Wilson's from Wrangell. We mentioned Tenneke Springs. We mentioned Juneau. We have a great piece of Southeast Alaska right behind you. For the sake of the record, could you point to Wrangell, point to Tenneke Springs, and then the limit where Gooey Ducks exist, and then where you expect to place them?
Sure. Wrangell is right here, and Tenneke Springs, the northern range, is here, according to Fish and Game. And right now, the permitted farm above that range is up here at Bridget Cove. And the this bill would allow the people in these areas to, along the Gulf of Alaska, to also apply for Gooey Duck permits, as long as there wasn't something in the area that would prohibit it. In that,
I'm from Homer, and this area here, Kachemak Bay, has a critical habitat area. And so in that critical habitat area plan, bottom farming of shellfish is not allowed. So gooey ducks would not be allowed because nothing in this bill overrides a local management plan. All it does is say that Fish and Game will not use the absence of gooey ducks from someplace here as the criteria to say you can't have a farm.
Representative Guttenberg?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, being from Fairbanks, my gooey duck experience has been limited to this room over the past many years. So if my questions seem naive, please bear with me. What's the rationale from the department for gooey ducks not being farther north and west? Have they explained? Is there a theory on why they haven't propagated farther?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guttenberg, we have not had that explanation. I mean, animals have their geographic ranges. Could be photo period, you know, it could be temperature. Oftentimes you have temperature ranges where animals don't reproduce above a certain temperature. So if that was the case, you wouldn't expect them up here where it's too cold for them to reproduce. There's kind of, you have maps in there of the larval drift zones that they've shown where they basically, there's a larval drift zone here and another here, and then one in southeastern. That doesn't explain why they haven't seen them north of Tenneke Springs, but it just, you know, I mean, it's like beaver are now going up to Nome. They didn't used to be at Nome.
Still, yeah.
You know, you've got expanding ranges for moose over what they've been. I mean, that could be photo period, could be temperature, but that's the same thing that happens with oysters. Oysters do not, up in this area, do not become reproductively active because it's just too cold. If you warm up the water enough, then they'll go ahead and spawn, but they don't spawn up there because of the water temperature, but they grow well. I mean, it's a fantastic product up there. In fact, it's a better product. I won't say it. Better not say that. I mean, it's better as far as marketing because they never go into the spawn, and when they go into the spawn, they get bitter. So you don't have to worry about not being able to market your product at a particular time because they never go into the spawn. So I don't want to get into the in a fight of who's got the best fish.
Thank you, Mr. I have a few follow questions, up, if I may. Well, along that line, but a little bit different on. You know, sometimes the bill is about just slightly more than a page, and there's, you know, some things come out at me that on line 10, well, the first chapter, section 1, you allow, and then you talk about in the second sentence, which is the last half of the paragraph, the permit may not allow for operations that are in the intertidal habitat or environment. So I don't understand where their habitat is if it's not in the intertidal habitat. So am I missing something, or is the commissioner issues a permit for an aquatic farm or cultured geoducks in a management area that doesn't have wild geoduck stocks when the permit is issued? And the permit may not allow operations for that purpose in the intertidal habitat. Isn't that where they are? You're going to be growing them? Or have I missed?
Through the chairman. They're bottom dwellers. Intertidal means that becomes exposed during low tide. In Washington, much of the farming is done intertidally. And you'll see all these little pieces of plastic with the screen on top. So mostly it's so that birds won't go down and eat the seed while they're starting out. There's, first of all, north of Tenneke Springs, north of this area, I doubt that you're going to be successful intertidally. You get a lot colder temperature. You get colder temperatures at night. Out in our areas, we get really cold temperatures compared to Puget Sound, and we get, you know, the freezing, and we get the weather and those kind of things. So I think it would not work well, but there is some concern by people that if you try and farm these intertidally,
what you're going to do is you're going to displace existing uses. That is, people that go along the beach and dig clams or that collect seaweed or something else. These clams exist down to 300 and some feet in Puget Sound. I mean, they're part of the, most of the, they're probably the most, the largest portion of the biomass, some estimates are, in, down there. Mostly between 10 and 80 feet deep. And generally, for the operations here, it's, you're less than 30 feet. You know, you're 10 to 30 feet deep is where is the operational, because then a diver can operate for long periods of time.
So you're just protecting the existing intertidal use?
That's right. Okay. Yes.
If I may.
Well, I'm just going to ask another question. They're never exposed to the air. Is that correct?
In down in Washington, there, you know, all it shows is a little top of the siphon, and they can pull that down a little bit. But they do exist intertidally in the mudflats down in
Washington.
And so they're not up laying on the surface, but they are there in the intertidal area. Of course, that's warmer country.
Yeah.
But, and everything else.
But the much tastier, much more expensive Alaskan gooey duck.
That's right.
Always subtitled.
Well, they're harvested here by the divers, and I think there's somebody representing the divers that'll be testifying. Actually, I think that the Bridget Cove permit has intertidal, can be intertidal, and you know, that'll be up to the permittee as to whether it works for them or not. But it's, you know, the further north you go, the worse the conditions are. And this bill just takes that away from being a problem with these, you know, with the problem of subsistence sport or commercial users of an area having a conflict.
Representative Guttenberg.
So you limit the use of the contiguous Gulf of Alaska. What about out on the Aleutians or in Bristol Bay? Has there been any rationale for not doing it there? I mean, you're expanding it out to these other areas, and what's the purpose of just limiting it to the Gulf?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guttenberg, if someone from up there wanted to come and you know, talk about it, that'd be, you know, be willing to talk. Okay. There is no definite demarcation other than that this is just generally the area that we were talking about, and I'm sure if we started talking about the Beaufort Sea, Fish and Game would go livid. So I can pretty much say that, you know, the species and everything within the Gulf of Alaska has a very broad distribution, and they can be different than those that are up in the Bering Sea.
Two more quick questions, if I may.
Go ahead.
I know there's, you know, and we've seen it in some of the emails, some of the concern about, you know, the potential habitat changes. Has there been any discussion with transference of the seed that was sterilized? Is there any way of doing that, making sure they can't propagate? Is that possible, Dell?
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, there's a theoretical possibility. Nobody has done this in gooey ducks. They've done that in some clams. I do find it strange that people are talking about playing with the genetics of creatures and then saying they would permit genetically changed stocks to be introduced. Fish and Game has not said that they would support it. They said that if there was a triploid or some genetically chains or sterile animals, they would consider it. They have not said that they would support that. But basically what is being asked is for these small farmers that might want to do this to somehow fund basic research. My understanding is that University in British Columbia, I think it is trying to, it could be University of Washington. Anyway, they're attempting to do this for down south. They haven't been successful yet. There's no reports of it. Basically, what's happened is there's some sterilization that had been done with some animals, and they, you know, the idea is, well, maybe if you go and do 10 years of basic research and are able to do something, then maybe we'll do it. But they've also testified that about 1% of the sterile animals are not sterile anyway. So the question is, if your fear is that you would be putting non-sterile animals out here, if you have 1% non-sterile, I mean, you're going to start a population because you're going to have non-sterile animals out there, and you know, once you start, there's not a whole lot of difference. The probability is that they're going to be functionally sterile because of the colder water anyway. We don't know that for sure, but like I say, nobody's ever made sterile gooey ducks, and so it's kind of a I look at the risks of this animal, and I don't see them there with this animal.
One more question, Mr. Chair.
Proceed.
Thank you. So right now what it is that the commissioner uses the absence of gooey ducks to not permit aquatic farming. You're taking that away, and if something happens or the experiment goes amiss or the farming goes amiss, this is the simple, broadest term that the commissioner would have to say, okay, that didn't work. If they don't exist where they are now or were previous to this date, then there's no more farming. You're taking that authority away from him as an excuse. So is there another way to define that simply you could, instead of saying he can't use that as a denial to give the commissioner authority and say, well, that is the reason we don't want to do that?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I'm not quite sure. I think that the commissioner is actually probably, if he's denying these permits, is probably in the violation of the law anyway, because House Bill 208 that was passed in 2002 specifically says that the permits for gooey ducks will be, two conditions were given. One is that there are no gooey ducks in the area. And the other was that if there is a population of gooey ducks, it must be insignificant. And so the commissioner is denying the permits based on the absence of gooey ducks in the area, which is in direct violation of what was passed previously. However, and we've looked at the record, and there's nothing in the record that said that they only intended that to be for Southeastern. You know, this is really a clarifying bill, saying that the big problem with gooey ducks here has been with the farms and permits is that there are gooey ducks in most of these areas, and where people want to put farms are in areas where you have good upwelling and where you have gooey ducks. Well, then you have a wild stock, which the dive industry wants to harvest, and that's exactly where people want to site the farm. So that has been what the big gooey duck contention has been in the past. How do we take a resource which all of us own out there, and it has been historically targeted by a commercial fishery, and now turn that in part of that area into a farm? And that's not a problem for anywhere up here. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, thank you.
Just add some fuel to this fire. Zebra mussels, introduced accidentally in the Great Lakes, discovered that the inside of a sewer pipe was just a very fine home and raised large families until they clogged the pipes. And had no concern over that. You go in and route the pipes out, they clogged them again and again, so it became a perennial problem. And then, has anyone in here not seen Jurassic Park? The dinosaurs were males or females, males only, I think is what it was. And I remember the statement, they found a way, which I thought was baloney, but they found a way. So the extension of that point being, zebra mussels were accidental. this is intentional with preparation ahead of time. Jurassic Park is a work of fiction, but makes us worry to some degree. I have serious concerns over introducing an animal in a place where it doesn't currently exist. But I'm not that strong on this issue because I think they've had their opportunity to spawn up there. You just can't leave eggs in the water that don't wind up in other places. And they clearly, I'm just willing to bet a nickel that some eggs have found their way all over. And like Representative Seaton says, cannot find the right environment. They just, if they did, they would settle in and make families. But they can't. I lost another train of thought here. Oh, yeah. And the reason being, he suggests, is water temperature. A perfectly good one. Perfectly good. If indeed global warming is here and continues to, and the sea currents change and the temperatures rise, they'll get there on their own. It won't be a real problem. But there is a species of pine tree in Florida that only releases seeds when there's a fire. Fire ecology is absolutely essential. You got to get the cones up to 100 or some huge number of degrees, and then they pop. No fire, no popping, no new trees. Pretty simple. And I think this, what he's saying here is no heat, no reproduction. The only ones that will be there are the ones you put there. It's kind of like your garden. You plant things in your garden, but if you leave it alone, it's over. It's over. The weeds come back. And I believe that's where we're heading on this, is that should we take this risk? It's a risk. But my gosh, showing up in this building is a risk. And walking on the street is a risk. And I try to measure, and I think you do too, everything. Is a certain risk involved. So it becomes to a risk-reward ratio. Do we do it? Should we do it? Should we try it? Well, we've had plenty of problems with introduced species. In fact, it was before this committee that we were talking about purple loosestrife and orange hawkweed and Kodiak. And then the representative who introduced the bill to eliminate purple loosestrife and orange hawkweed gave us a pamphlet that had all the other ones that were also non-native, that had having a great time in Kodiak and other places that we'd love to get rid of. And I know in my own home, we have the bird vetch driving me crazy. It just crawls over things, and if you try and run through it, it trips you. This is amazing stuff. And you pull it away, but if there's anything, a fence, another tree, a plant, it crawls over it. It is introduced, and it makes me sad. So are dandelions. But all of these are unintentional introductions. This one Representative Seaton has is well beyond unintentional. It is actually going to require money and effort and time. And I personally believe, and that's why I support the bill at this point, that the work has been done that says, you know, if it works, fine. If it doesn't work, we're no worse off. And when we plant something in our garden, if it grows, fine. If it doesn't grow, all right, too bad. Go find something else. Although there are some in the garden that seem to be fairly adaptive and tolerant to the worst possible conditions. But I'm going to place my risk-reward with Representative Seaton on this and say, this is conceivably a well-thought-out plan. I'm going to listen to the rest of the testimony. It's just that after reading the literature, taking a good look at it, having a similar background to what he has, and being terrified over doing something that will burn us later on, I'm willing to take that risk unless there's some testimony that really comes at us from somewhere else that says, let me give you an example of where this was tried and how it wiped out the ocean, the communities, and everybody had to leave town, and now the land is worthless. I mean, I have to hear something, some evidence that this has a problem. So with that, is there any more testimony from the committee?
Just wondering if you're going to farm these on the McNeil River.
McNeil River, bear food.
There's your segue. There's your segue to the next bill.
I like it. They like things that wiggle and fly up, jump out of the water, and I don't know that this is going to get there. But we have in the audience here, Roger, is it? Could you pronounce your last name for me?
Painter.
P-A-I-N-T-E-R?
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry I didn't read it that way, but please step forward and welcome to the Resources Committee. And I'm looking forward to, you're with the Alaska Shellfish
Growers Association.
So we usually try to start out with name and affiliation and any thing that attaches to you that shows that your interest is through the Alaska Shellfish Growers Association. Are you their
president?
Appointed, voted?
Voted.
So strong association. Thanks, Mr. Painter. Please, go ahead.
For the record, my name is Roger Painter, and I'm president of the Alaskan Shellfish Growers Association. And I'd like to speak in favor of this bill. I think this is a very simple bill and really shouldn't raise the red flags of exotic species, genetic nightmares, or disease. I think Representative Gatto made some very good points about this particular animal. And if this were something to allow just any animal that anybody suggested, it probably wouldn't be a good idea. In fact, I think it would be a very bad idea. But gooey ducks simply do not pose any threat that we have been able to determine either to the habitat or other fisheries resources. I think it's important to keep that in mind. These are not zebra mussels or Asian carp or any other species that has turned out to be a real problem in other areas. This is an animal that doesn't move. It's a very clean animal. It has very, very little effect on the environment it lives in, and does not, gooey duck beds are predominantly gooey ducks. They're not a mix of a bunch of other species. They live in a real sandy habitat, and contrary to what Representative Seaton suggested, Mr. Chair, gooey ducks are sometimes found in the intertidal area in Alaska. Not very many of them. They don't extend very far, but I've seen them myself, and I know they do reach the intertidal area here occasionally. I think in terms of disease, the committee needs to understand that Alaska has probably the strongest pathology, shellfish pathology program in the United States. Very stringent requirements that both the animals brought into the hatchery need to be tested, and certainly the progeny need to be tested before they are planted out in the environment. The stocks that are planted are disease-free. Any diseases that gooey ducks would pick up after that point would be coming from the environment in which they're located. In terms of genetics, I'm surprised that this issue was even raised. It's pretty obvious that if you're trying to locate these animals in an area where there are no native stocks, there really shouldn't be any genetic concerns. there is a pretty big division between Southeast Alaska and Prince William Sound in terms of the way the water flows. And it's very, very difficult to see how the animals could ever make that leap. Everything is carried in the opposite directions. Very well established, I might add, by the Exxon Valdez oil spill, where we saw those little tar balls traveling from Prince William Sound through Cook Inlet and down the Alaska Peninsula. I also would like to just briefly address this issue of natural range of the species. This is an argument that, of course, Fish and Game use very strongly. The natural range of the species is a moving target. The location of these animals, the range of these animals, will change as the ocean environment changes. And there's some evidence that gooey ducks used to exist in Kachemak Bay. And in 20 years, if the oceans continue to warm, we may indeed see them in Kachemak Bay again. A real moving target, just what is that natural range of the species? If we want to take a snapshot in time and try to limit to everything to what we see today, I would suggest we don't have a very good vision. As most of you understand, the area where we're sitting now used to be under a bunch of ice. There weren't any salmon here. There weren't many species here that we see today. I'd like to offer another example of what might happen. The department and its fun facts in your packet throughout zebra mussels and Asian carp and other species. But I'd also like to point out that last year the Russians sold about $250 million worth of king crab that were harvested from the Barents Sea. These stocks are that they were harvesting are progeny of stocks that were transplanted from the Bering Sea to the Barents Sea in the 1950s. And I think I would, it might be something the committee wants to ask a community like Kodiak what it would think of a shot in the arm of a $250 million harvest. I think they would probably like that a lot. I'd also like to relate to you what the response of my gooey duck farmers were to this bill. I found very little concern about competition for seed or market competition or any other concerns. Their response of the people I talked to was it would sure be nice to solve the problems we have with the Department of Fish and Game with our gooey duck permits before we move on to another venture, and they hesitate to push that experience on to other people in this state. I'd also like to point out that contrary to Fish and Game testimony, the department has approved past experiments with moving species beyond their natural range. I personally had a permit to take purple hinge rock scallops from southeast and plant them on Unalaska Island, Chernofsky Harbor in Unalaska Island, Unfortunately, we weren't able to complete that experiment because as we were transporting the animals from southeast to Unalaska Island, they got caught in some bad weather, and they died in the Anchorage airport before I could get them out there. But we did get the permits, I'd point out, so it is possible, contrary to what was suggested by the Department of Fish and Game. I'd also like to mention that I understand the concerns about the intertidal culture, but as a lifelong Alaskan and someone who's interested in resident participation in economic development, I'd point out that probably the lowest cost way to get involved in geoduck farming is through intertidal culture. And for small-scale farmers, the most likely way for them to participate is through intertidal culture. So I'd just like to throw that out. Also, like to voice some reservations about undertaking geoduck farming up north. And those reservations are, if I were the person applying for permits, I'd be a little concerned about the growth rates of these animals. We don't know a whole lot about the biology of geoducks, but one thing we do know is that they're pretty lethargic at temperatures below 50 degrees Fahrenheit. And when farmers go out to plant juvenile geoducks, they always wait until the waters are above 50 degrees, so they'll actively dig themselves in. In the winter fisheries for dive fisheries for geoducks, and I'm sure the divers will confirm this, the animals don't show very much. The dimples in the sand are not very visible, and that's because they're not actively feeding. As the temperature cools, they're not really actively feeding at that point. When they're actively feeding, you might even see their necks sticking out of the ground, laying on the bottom of the ocean. If you look at the number of days the water temperatures exceed 50 degrees in Cook Inlet or Prince William Sound or Kodiak, be many fewer than southern southeast Alaska. So it would just be my guess that the growth rates would be slow enough where it wouldn't be economically viable, and I'd be real hesitant to invest my own money to do that. I'd also like to just make a few corrections. One,
could I ask you to, yes, I don't know, sir, how much more you have to go here?
I'm just about done here.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to add a few corrections and things that are on the record. And one is that Tom Manning's farm at Bridget Cove does have geoducks in it. Not very many. It's sort of an experimental level farm, but there are geoducks in the farm. Information submitted by the Department of Fish and Game, there's a couple of things I'd like to correct. In terms of the larval drift zones, the involvement of the Shellfish Growers Association was that we came into these proposing that the larval drift zones be eliminated. The department at the same time came in proposing that they be increased from 3 to 12 zones. After a bunch of negotiations, we ended up at 6. It wasn't that we were thrilled about 6, but that was the best we were going to get, contrary to what the department suggests. Also, the department memorandum says that it would take a change in statutes to allow the importation of aquatic stocks into the state of Alaska. That's not the case, Mr. Chair. The importation of aquatic stocks is regulated by the Board of Fisheries, and they can, through regulation, allow even exotic species into the state. The board does have that power. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Mr. Painter. Cynthia is here for questions and answers.
I have a question for Mr. Painter.
I'm sorry, before you leave, Representative Wilson has a question.
Did I hear you say that they might hibernate?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I wouldn't exactly call it hibernating, but one of the things that's pretty unique about gooey ducks is their retention of the toxin and paralytic shellfish poisoning. And you could go down into one very small area, say 1 square foot, and dig out 3 clams, and you would see toxin levels all over the board. And what probably accounts for that is that most of the fisheries are taking place during the winter months. Some of these animals were probably feeding and flushed out these toxins, others did not. And whether you call that hibernating or not, I don't know. But it's not exactly a hibernation, but something close to that.
Okay. Thanks very much, sir. Cynthia's from Fish and Game. Is she here?
I am here, but we have testimony from John.
Right, right. He's
and Jim C.
Both of those will be up shortly. Alan Austerman. Oscar. AUS.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Alan Austerman. I'm here testifying on my own behalf today. For the last 4 years, I've spent a lot of time working with the shellfish industry trying to come up with some resolution in how this industry can expand and grow. It's been difficult, to say the least. Not all the problems are created by the last administration, the Murkowski administration. When you go back further into the shellfish industry, back in the Knowles administration, they had regulations, I'd say, stacked about this high, and when they were trying to get this industry started. Currently, they're down to maybe this high. And so this last administration has made some good steps in trying to move forward with this industry and get it going. There are some inherent problems, though, between what the Department of Fish and Game manages as wild stocks versus the farm industry. And their mandate is to manage the wild stocks. And at the last testimony at the Fish Committee, the department even indicated that they're not mandated, it's not part of their mandate to concern themselves so much with the farming side of the product. To me, this really is an economic development issue. It's really trying to develop more economy in the state of Alaska. And moving gooey ducks from one part of the state to the other, I don't see a real problem with. I do think it gives us the opportunity to expand some of the economics. The discussion you guys had earlier in reference to hatcheries and some of the problems there, those problems with the hatchery were created by the fact that during the whole process of trying to permit and get this gooey duck industry going, there's just been roadblocks after roadblocks. Again, that goes back to partly to the Knowles administration when they started permitting these farms. Had they permitted them in an area where there were no gooey ducks, it would have solved a lot of the problems that we have today, and we would be a lot further along in this industry than we are today. The conflicts between there being wild stocks on a farm and then the farmer going in and pulling those wild stocks off has created a lot of controversy and problems. The hatchery consequently built itself up thinking that this industry and the gooey duck industry was going to grow and expand, and it didn't, and it hasn't. and consequently the hatchery has suffered through that whole process. 2 years ago, there was an effort in Ketchikan to start to find the funds to put in a hatchery, shellfish hatchery. That didn't take place either, and I think it was because it was obvious that this industry was not moving along fast enough to support two. It was very difficult for it to have for it to support the Seward hatchery at the time. The king crab research project that's going on in Seward right now at that hatchery is going to help quite a bit trying to bring the viability of the hatchery up enough so that it survives till we can get the geoduck and the rest of the shellfish farming going on and justify the. I was very disappointed when zebra mussels was used as an example of introduced species and why you don't want to do that. As we all know, zebra mussels are ground cover. I mean, they go in, and as the chairman talked about, when they were introduced in the Great Lakes, they go in and choke off pipes because they're like a ground cover, and they just go in and kill everything. Whereas clams are down under the substrate, and they're got their neck up, and they're filtering water. They're not going in and destroying the whole area. So I think it was like apples and oranges. I just don't see the difference. The issue during reference to whether you should have sterile the clams that you're moving and putting in, I think you've covered that fairly well enough to understand that the conditions of reproduction are not there. They would be if this was a warmer area, but what, you know, I would venture a guess that 1,000 years ago there was not a geoduck in Southeast Alaska either. There is an evolution, whether it's dinosaurs or geoducks, or, you know, that's going to take place. And eventually at some point in time, I think that we will see a reproduction of geoducks all along the coast. Not in my grandkids' life or your lives or any of our lives, but at some point in time it probably will happen. And what if it does? What is the problem? What kind of problem? Nobody's been able to show what the problem would be if they reproduced and grew in an area where they aren't going today. Again, I think that in Southeast they weren't there a number of years ago. There's a number of different issues that eventually the U.S. legislature will get involved in, I believe, in reference to the shellfish industry. Part of it will be that maybe the farming side of this whole process, because of the problems that they're created, needs to be moved from the Department of Fish and Game and moved into DNR, and where they've got a Division of Agriculture, which is the farming side. And I'm not trying to take anything away from Fish and Game. I've had this discussion with them on several different occasions, both the prior commissioner and the new commissioner, and I don't think it's a bad idea. I didn't get any real strong objections to the concept of doing that. We ran out of time in trying to get to that point, but I think that it may happen at some point in time, just so this industry has grabbed the opportunity to become an economic viable tool for Alaska. That's my end of my testimony, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I'm going to make a couple of comments before you leave. That is, the zebra mussel example was simply to associate an introduced species, not that it's a different kind. We know it's a different kind. And then your reference to the evolution is really a reference to migration, and that is, species do migrate. Thank God they do.
Yeah.
Thank you. We do have a couple of Fish and Game people now. John Hilsinger.
John? Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, go ahead and give us your affiliation.
Sure. My name is Jim Sieb. I'm the chief fishery scientist with Fish and Game. And John Hilsinger, our new director for commercial fisheries, is also in the room.
Thank you.
I just have a few comments. A lot of the testimony that I wanted to give is actually been covered somewhat. Roger Painter made a really good point when he said that area north of Cape Fairweather on up to Cape St. Elias is a real barrier to migration for many, many animals. There are a lot of species that occur in Southeast Alaska naturally that don't occur in South Central Alaska because of that barrier. And we've got some serious concerns over the uncertainty that's associated with any kind of a fish or shellfish introduction. So the I guess the situation that we see is that there are gooey duck larvae naturally occurring throughout southeast Alaska, and they settle on some beaches and develop thriving populations. But there are gooey duck larvae everywhere in the drift zone down there, but they don't occur naturally in south central Alaska. And if transplanted, the consequences are uncertain. They may not do well. They may not reproduce. But if they do reproduce, the females have millions of larvae every year, and they could spread rapidly and have really. I guess the point is we don't know what the consequences would be to the natural ecosystem. They could compete in the water column. They could cause predator buildup for other species. They could compete in the food web. They could just alter the food web in ways that we can't predict. The example was given that red king crab transplanted into the Barents Sea provide a thriving fishery, but those same crab have migrated down into the Norwegian Sea and have completely disrupted the economy of Norway with their cod fisheries. So there are huge international issues that are developing over this red king crab fishery that has proven to be a short-term benefit to one area, but it's proven to be a long-term, really negative economic impact to another area. So these are the kinds of uncertainties that come with introducing species, and if we spend any time at all on the World Wide Web just typing in the word introduced species, you'll see example after example after example of catastrophic unintended consequences that can result. Often there are short-term benefits that result that might provide an economic gain during our lifetime, but the unintended consequences tend to accumulate decades down the road. I don't want to belabor. I just want to express the fact that we do have concern that we really don't know how to predict what will happen if we introduce a species throughout or a species beyond its native range.
Is that it?
Yep, that's it. I can answer some questions, or maybe our new director, John Hilsinger, would like to say a word or two.
And I thought John would be testifying. Your name is Jim C.
Jim Seeb, S-E-E-B.
Okay, because we have a recording secretary here, and she needs to get the names just correct. John, are you going to be testifying?
Mr. Chairman, I don't really have much to add beyond what Jim said. I think we are very concerned about the potential for species introductions and into areas where they don't exist, and typically they don't exist there for a variety of reasons, and we don't always know the reasons why they don't exist. And so the fact that these animals don't exist in an area doesn't mean that they can't be transplanted in there and become very numerous and potentially cause some problems. So I wouldn't assume that these animals can't survive and reproduce in a place like Prince William Sound or Kachemak Bay. Thank you. That's all I have to add.
And before you leave, I do have a question for you. What if they do reproduce? Are they in an area, as has been mentioned by Mr. Osterman, who cares? Is it an area that threatens some other area? Because I think there are probably plenty of places. Well, fish farming occurs in places that was a high risk, and we have suffered from that. I'm going to say we do have Atlantic salmon up here where we don't want them showing up in southeast here. But they're able to swim. These poor guys are not very good swimmers. So if indeed someone were to ask you the question, who cares? You would say, I care, and then I need you to kind of follow up on that, because you did mention you care because you don't want any introduced species, or you care because this species in particular is suspect.
Well, Mr. Chairman, these animals do move. They have a fantastic larval drift. Each female produces millions and millions of larvae every year. And these enter the currents and drift from area to area. And we just don't have the information to know if they would reproduce in South Central or not. But if they did, they could spread and disrupt other species inhabiting that area, disrupt the food web in ways that we can't predict. Most introductions that have catastrophic impacts, those are impacts that weren't predicted. The state of Montana introduced mysa shrimp into Flathead Lake. Mysa shrimp are a nice-sized zooplankton that they felt that this would enhance the kokanee population. The kokanee were feeding on Daphnia at the time, and the state thought that by introducing this shrimp species, they would actually enhance kokanee production. And it turned out, to their surprise, that the mysa shrimp were never available to the kokanee in the water column. The shrimp and the kokanee had different up and down migrations during the photo period during the day, and the mysa shrimp, in fact, became predators and ate all the Daphnia, and the kokanee population crashed. The eagles that depended on the kokanee crashed, and the bears left. So the state was in a real fix because they had good intentions and introduced a species into an area that didn't exist, but there were unintended consequences that rippled through the ecosystem. And there are so many incidents of this kind of occurrence that states everywhere are very cautious about this kind of thing. And in fact, our larval drift zones that we've set up are far more liberal than the drift zones in Washington and Canada, in part because of pressure from the industry. We actually did work with Roger and listened to him and tried to make compromises that could facilitate their development.
Let me just go on with one more question. I've been over to Polly Creek with a shovel and a pail looking for razors. If indeed these larvae drifted over right over Polly Creek and decided to settle in there, that is intertidal, do you think that they could outcompete the razor clams, or if not outcompete them, coexist with them, and if not coexist with them, die off before that ever happened?
Well, I would hesitate to forecast it, any or all of those. Again, the outcome of transplanting species outside of their native range is really unpredictable, and they may settle in some areas. They may cause competition problems in the water column. If we have millions of larvae of a new species, maybe those larvae will outcompete existing larvae from little necks or other natives. So the impacts are unpredictable, and the impacts wouldn't be limited to those that would occur after settling occurred. They could occur anywhere in the food web.
Peggy, Representative Peggy Wilson has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question, and I don't know for sure who could answer this, but looking at the longitudinal lines, or the latitudinal lines, from over there where Southeast is, over to here, and I think it corresponds to over here at the middle of the Aleutians there. Is the water over here as warm as the water over there? And it probably isn't, but I don't know that.
I don't have current and temperature books with me. There are pretty fixed oceanic currents and temperatures that lay down in certain patterns. They change through the decades, but we don't just use latitude to predict temperature. It could be warmer or cooler, actually.
Yeah, well, I was just wondering if there might be a better place that would be a possible place to have these grow, but I didn't know.
Okay. Is it for...
Yes.
Representative Guttenberg has a question for you.
Thank you. You know, I'm concerned there's been some interesting discussion on the ramifications of doing this, and what it could be in the long term. But I'm interested in your zero fiscal note, why, if this passes, it will have no impact. You're going to have to doing staying ahead on research, or certainly starting. I mean, I know we don't want a fiscal note, but you are going to have to be doing some research on this, or looking at it. Do you expect to not be doing any research or field studies?
I'm the chief scientist. I'm sorry, I probably can't exactly answer that. I know that our commissioner has been following the governor's lead and trying to be very frugal on anything that we ask for. I do agree that I think research on this, whether or not gooey ducks are transplanted outside the native range, there can be a very good argument made to fund more kinds of gooey duck research. In fact, we have co-authored proposals with the previous operators of the hatchery to try to bring research dollars into the hatchery to study a variety of topics, including the development of sterile scallops and that kind of thing. I believe that the hatchery now raises several kinds of bivalves, maybe six or eight different species.
Okay, and you said you're a chief scientist?
That's correct.
Okay, I'd like to make sure that that's in the record. The sector. And hang in there, Representative Seaton has a question for you.
Yeah, Mr. Hilsinger, what do gooey ducks compete with in Southeastern, or what would you say they displaced in the habitat in Southeastern?
Well, Representative Seaton, gooey ducks occur naturally down there, and there's very little. I think that you've actually covered the competition in the substrate very clearly. I think a few tunicate worms, perhaps. Certainly, when you have a species that's a part of a food web, a part of an ecosystem, there's natural predation and competition that keeps things in balance. And honestly, I don't quite understand fully the impacts in the larval drift area when we have millions of larvae from many different species co-migrating. I'm not sure what the competition would be.
Follow up?
Well, I guess what I'm trying to find out is there anything that you can identify for me that's in the area, let's say Kodiak or Prince William Sound, that is different than is in the ecological niche in Southeastern that you would anticipate might be displaced by adult gooey ducks in this case? Or are you mainly talking about the larvae in the plankton?
Well, sir, I think as I pointed out with both the red king crab example and the mice and shrimp example, the results can be really unpredictable, and we don't know what impacts could occur, but we know from the history of introducing species throughout the globe that there are often unintended consequences. They're often very serious, and because of that, states and nations globally don't endorse introducing species without some very serious research ahead of time. And we haven't done the research to know what could occur.
So, Mr. Chairman, follow up.
Follow up.
So there's not something other than tunicates or the polychaete worms or something else in the mud substrate that different species that you're talking about in South Central that would be displaced by gooey ducks that you've identified? It's a just general concern. Is that correct?
That's correct. We're not worried about displacement as much as ecosystem change. So the impact of introducing gooey ducks might not be displacement in the substrate. It might be displacement in the water column. It might be a buildup of predators. Perhaps billions and billions of new larvae drifting in an area would cause some primary predator to develop in that area, and that predator may then have an impact on native bivalves. I don't mean to be vague, but we simply don't know what the consequences could be, and displacement isn't our primary concern. It's a disruption of the food web.
There's some reading material here. I just wanted to get something really clear. Is it Panopia abrupta or Panopia generosa? Both of those the same critter?
I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that.
I mean, they're separate species, very clearly. I don't know if they both go under the name of gooey duck. So when we talk about Pacific gooey duck clam or anything else, the only way to know what we're talking about for sure is to skip the common name, which is sometimes king clam or elephant trunk clam, and talk about the generic name so that we are very lucky here today. we have the taxonomist in front of us.
Well, I can't say I'm a taxonomist. Chairman Gatto, I am Cynthia Pringham with Fish and Game, the Mariculture Coordinator. Those two species names are the same. Abrupta is the current name that we're using, but the previous one was used and then replaced by Abrupta. So they're both the same organism, same genus species.
Among the species, I'm sorry, among the genus of these critters?
Yeah.
Is there a wide range of species?
I don't know all of them that are existing for Panopea, but there are a couple of them within the Northwest region. But I can get that information. I don't know all of them.
But don't leave. Now I'm going to ask you water column questions.
Okay.
When we talk about a water column, they're feeding in the bottom millimeter, and the water column is pretty well mixing all the time. Is it possible to extract from the water column just their favorite food and therefore cause a bloom in the remainder, or has anybody looked into this?
You know, I'm not real familiar with all the research that's been done, but you're talking about the adults and the adults eating phytoplankton right there where they're residing. I don't know how much they utilize. There have been discussions with oysters and all that about them causing an impact. I don't have enough information, and I don't think research has been done on that particular issue.
Don't go away.
Okay.
Are they eating only phytoplankton or zooplankton also?
Phytoplankton.
And at the levels they're at, phytoplankton probably are not photosynthesizing, are they?
They're down pretty deep, yeah. It just depends. I mean, if they're in the intertidal area, yes, you're going to have some light penetration there. But
clearly we have some that are very deep where it's black as coal. And they're feeding on phytoplankton there too?
Phytoplankton, they do kind of migrate within the water column.
And that's the point. The water column is pretty well mixing all the time. It's not likely they could be a disturbance then in the water column, because they're just filtering everything that comes next to them. So I only had this one concern, that is it possible for them to actually cause a bloom by removing only a segment of the water column, but it would have to be pretty still for them to be able to do that.
I really can't answer that. I'm just not sure.
On you?
So there are a lot of unknowns in the world of oceanography, and we just have scraped the surface on what our knowledge is of it. But
okay. Representative Wilson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is simply, I assume that you haven't done any more research on gooey ducks just because the legislature hasn't funded money to do that. And if you were to start doing some research, would someone else have to be hired to do it, or could the people that are there now do it?
Chairman Gatto, through you, Representative Wilson, to address your question, we have existing staff that use existing funding that comes through either the legislature or, via federal funds. Right now, we don't have research for gooey ducks besides just reconnaissance surveys that are done for the commercial fishery. I don't know what we can do with the existing people, but I would assume that they're already pretty packed with the work and tasks that the funding is for, and that additional money for staff would have to be utilized if the department does it. Again, the priorities can be changed depending on what the commissioner wants, but we may have to go out for contract. That's another possibility, and that's done in other states. A lot of the research in Washington is being done by University of Washington on gooey ducks, so that's probably the route we would take if that's what's offered.
Any other questions? Jeff, Jeff Hetrick, are you online?
Thank you, Chairman.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you fine. You're the director of the Shellfish Hatchery?
Yes, I am. I'm sorry I came in late to the conversation. I've been listening about a half an hour.
Well, you missed a lot. But I bet information you can give us is probably pretty significant, and I ask, please go on with your testimony.
Maybe I would be best to answer questions. I heard some discussions. I heard my colleague Roger Painter there from the Shellfish Growers talk about a lot. I think perhaps I was asked prior to this meeting about the possibility of triploidy and the technology and the state of development for that type of treatment of the gooey ducks. And some states, triploidy or tetraploidy is used as a management tool to alleviate the concerns for introductions in terms of having reproductive stocks. And the state of that technology right now, as I see it, is pretty proven for oysters, but not really proven for all the other shellfish species. I know that some colleagues of mine in the Pacific Northwest have looked at that. There were some proposals submitted to different funding agencies that were not funded. But the state of that technology is really not to the point where that would solve the issues that we're talking about today. A lot of these discussions I'm hearing have been theoretical and have been bantered around for over 20 years in terms of introductions and competition. Examples where the consequences were not foreseen that would happen with introductions. But I think with gooey ducks, Mr. Painter stated pretty bluntly, you're really looking at what would the competition be. Mr. Steve indicated that perhaps it'd be, these gooey ducks might be reproductive and fill the water column up. And I think if that were to happen and there was a lot of gooey ducks around, there'd be a lot of wealthy people. I don't know if that'd necessarily be a bad thing. So I think perhaps maybe I should just answer questions.
I have one, and for the sake of the audience, you mentioned triploidy and tetraploidy. Could you give us a kind of a 101 on that?
I wish I perhaps could. There's several ways of doing this, but basically at fertilization process or shortly thereafter, something is introduced, typically a chemical, that will change a chromosomal makeup of the fertilized egg, making it sterile. And it's worked out fairly well. The reason that this was done, and it started with oysters, was to make them non-reproductive as maybe perhaps an introduced species, but also for market quality, because oysters that form gametes become very gooey and are not very marketable. So the idea was to have an animal that doesn't expend energy into reproduction to produce gametes, and also that energy could be turned into growth. I'd say the verdict's still out. A lot of the Pacific Northwest farmers still utilize that technology and raise triploides. The problem is that they have noise, is the word used, that natural spawn also gets into their beds, and so they still don't have a purely non-reproductive animal that they harvest. The second thing about triploidy is it's not 100% effective. So if you do it correctly, I hear a variety of different numbers, but you might have 99% that are sterile. So we can open up the box of what happens to that 1% that would not be sterile, and that the arguments would proceed from there.
I appreciate the class, and we're all going to put in for credit just as soon as you tell everybody else what a gamete is, because Representative Seaton and I laughed at each other here. But I'm kind of feeling comfortable that most of the audience probably never heard of a gamete.
A gamete's either an egg or a sperm.
Thank you. And when you combine the gametes, what do you get?
Zygote. Now you're going to get to A in biology 101.
Thanks very much. It's been more than entertaining. Anyone else to testify? I don't have. Oh, I have David Otness from Seward. David, are you there?
Yeah, that's correct. You pick me up?
Well, yeah, welcome to the Resources Committee, David. Identify any association that you have for me.
Okay, I'm a shellfish grower, have been involved in it for a number of years, have been involved going back to Governor Egan with the initial salmon hatcheries we got going. And most recently, I was a member of Governor Palin's Fish and Game Transition Team.
And did you have some testimony that you wanted to contribute?
Yes, I would, Chairman. I had quite a bit written out here, but I think my contemporaries are covering most of it. I would like to say that our relationship with Fish and Game has been pretty disappointing overall throughout this. We're not trying to, you know, collapse stocks or do anything, but there just seems to be this fear that it's the end of the world if we do anything proactive. And actually, we've got an industry here which should be worth several hundred million dollars a year to Alaska's coast easily once we get it up and off the ground. I just really feel we could do it. And that's 56 years of living here, talking and living from one end of the state to the other. And I just really hope we don't have to keep going to the legislature in order to get a working partnership with Fish and Game, because now it's just an overabundance of permits and doubts. And hell, we've been through the oil spill, the 64 quake wiped out most of the shellfish stock in Alaska, for crying out loud. I mean, some of us are getting pretty old here. We'd like to see a paradigm shift like the rest of the world has going on and switching over to mariculture. There's a lot about it that's clean. I'm not referring to finfish, but there's my sentiments as a third-generation fisherman in Alaska. Thank you.
David, before you leave, would you be in favor of fish farms?
No, I wouldn't, Chairman. I don't think Alaska requires anything like that outside the possibility of a rehabilitative adjunct to depressed stocks that we might have. But for nearshore profit, no, I just don't think so.
And one more, since it was brought up, did you find a change in the fishery following the Exxon Valdez spill with regard to shellfish?
Could you be a little more specific, please?
Did you find a reduced or dead shellfish as a result of the Exxon Valdez oil spill as the oil finally got to, and I assume you're farming in Seward?
Yes. However, at the time, we weren't farming there then, but it would have had significant damage with it. You know, I saw it all the way out to Chignik. I was long line fishing out in the Aleutians, and it definitely hit and did some damage wherever it went.
And have you seen an equivalent recovery?
It's kind of hard to say in terms of wild stock, because you get die-offs on beaches out west, and you'll have real healthy populations, and a particular worm will come through and wipe out the clams of a given area. But I couldn't, you know, unless I was observing it year after year in a given area, really give an accurate assessment.
Yeah, and I know you can't give an accurate assessment, but sometimes word of mouth and people that are able to document that it's no longer worth the time because of the harvest. And I know that has nothing to do with this bill, but we do have this other issue between the state and ExxonMobil and the oil spill, and receiving money for people who have lost a livelihood. And a lot of us don't have factual information, that you have numbers and dates and distances, but sometimes it helps to just know from individuals what their observations have been as far as, was about a month later, was about 2 years later, was about 5 years or 10 years later, things finally got back to normal, or never got back to normal. And that's the only reason I was asking, and I know if you don't know, that's okay. But I'm always looking for people who were actively involved in a fishery that was sensitive to the oil as it moved throughout the areas where it finally wound up.
Yeah, I understand. I'd like to offer up something a little more specific, but just for informational purposes, we've had a great number of other things occur here too. The salmon shark abundance, there's never been anything like it prior to the fish hatcheries in Prince William Sound. The dogfish, I watched them move over 10 years ago from southeast all the way out to Kodiak now. They're a huge nuisance, and yet they've got this totally protected status as if we're out there finning them for their little fins. And I just don't think we're addressing some of the other issues that could be bringing these stocks back for us. I mean, these fish are eating rockfish larvae, cod, everything out there, crab, shrimp, and we wonder why we can't get these populations back. Well, start with the predators is a good spot. But with your deference on this, allow me to get back to you with some research and let me collect my thoughts. I'm just basically 1 hour out of the hospital after major surgery, so I'm doing the best I can, but it's not all clear yet.
Well, some things take 10 years, others take 10 minutes, but listen, I very much appreciate you willing to contribute some of the background that you have. It helps, and I know it wasn't all on task for what we were dealing with geoducks, but the whole system is connected. Everything is connected. Gooey ducks, I'm sorry. Everything is connected to everything else. And I wanted to be to get as much information as we could in the committee. And so thank you again.
Okay, thank you for your time, committee.
Is there anyone else that wants to testify at this point, either on the air or in the room? Okay, we have very few minutes to go before the committee meeting has to end. So what I'm going to do then is we only have five people here. In order to pass this from committee would require all five votes. I'm going to hold it until the next hearing, and I believe we'll have a much larger group. With that, I will close the meeting because we have some more meetings to go to. Just a moment.
Did we have the other bill noticed for next week, or is it just under bills previously heard? If it is, we should.
I can open the bill.
Would you? Mm-hmm.
Okay, I can do that. All right. Before we adjourn, I'm going to do a favor to my friend over here who had his second bill, which was House Bill 127. The reason for introducing it is as soon as we introduce it now, we can hear it under bills previously heard. But it has to first be introduced. So I'd like to take a few minutes and introduce House Bill 127. Mr. Vice Chair, did you want to move?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to just introduce House Bill 127, which is to support putting part of the Kachemak special use area into the McNeil State Game Sanctuary. The response for this is that these are basically two small inholdings in the area of McNeil River and the Katmaya area, which is used for, has generated a huge economy in bear viewing. And that is being put somewhat at risk by a proposed hunt of these in these two small areas, which are which this bill would prevent. And so,
okay.
Appreciate you letting me introduce the bill.
Thank you, Mr.
Motion to move it out of committee.
We have some interesting people on the committee. No, I will hold this bill over until the next meeting also. And if you think gooey ducks took 2 hours, wait till we get to the McNeil River Game Sanctuary. We might as well bring our sleeping bags. So with that, the meeting is adjourned, and I appreciate you attending. Thank you.